Thank you for tuning in to this weekend's episode of Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and Lyon County's 92.3 FM Talk. First, a quick shout out to our sponsors, Out West Buildings, Truck Envy, and Legacy Sports International, home of the Howa Superlight. Now, a little bit of housekeeping stuff. We wanted to talk about the Wyoming Corner Crossing case. Seems like every time you read the industry publications or whatever, there's something new going on. So, Dave, you had brought this up earlier. The judge sided with the Missouri Hunters. I think we covered that.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
there's more detail now coming out as far as the entirety of the situation.
Yeah, well, from what I've last read was that he sided with the Missouri Hunters, saying that they were not trespassing because you can't trespass if you are just going through the airspace of the property, because the lawsuit that the rancher has against these hunters is that they, by crossing his property, have now damaged the value of his property.
Right, right.
And I guess his lawsuit's for like $7.75 million in damaged value to his ranch, which obviously that's not the case. But where it's going now, I guess, is one of the hunters had a waypoint on his Onyx hunt.
Waypoint 6.
Waypoint 6,
exactly. The grassy knoll of this case.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they're saying that that waypoint is on his property. It's like one mark on his property.
Okay.
And he's saying that is enough damage to cause the $7 million plus of damages to the value of his ranch.
Yeah.
But the judge is like, yeah, that's not the case because...
Well, you could drop waypoints anywhere.
That's it. And that's the argument right now, is that you could place a waypoint wherever you wish to place it. You just drag it.
Right.
And... that's the argument right now. There's the rancher and his attorneys are saying, nope, that was a push button. This is where I am waypoint. There's really no way to show that. It's
not. this goes back to that subpoena they had for the data on the guy's Onyx account or whatever. But yeah, you're absolutely correct. For people listening, those familiar with Onyx, I could sit here in the studio and I could drop waypoints all over a ridge in North Idaho if I want to. However, there is a feature on there, mark my location. So I don't know what the data shows. If it was a mark my location.
Yeah, I don't think it was, because if it was a drop pin at my location, then that would be, I mean, they'd be
then
stating that. They'd be stating that in these documents, but they're not. They're just saying that it's waypoint 6 is on the rancher's property.
Gotcha.
And that continues the lawsuit, which the big issue right now in the country, you know, hunters, not just hunters, but organizations and people in general are actually looking for and purchasing these checkerboard parcels.
Right.
With the intent to lock out hunters or recreationalists in order to gain trespass fees.
Caveat emptor, right? Uh-huh. Buyer beware.
Right.
I think this rancher, I thought I read something that he was even going after the real estate agent that sold him the property, because his understanding was that by purchasing that property, he would have exclusive access to that parcel of BLM land and that elk herd.
Correct.
So, I mean, part of me goes, okay, you idiot, you bought a private parcel of land, or you bought a ranch, there's no guarantee that that's going to be your exclusive access point to this BLM.
Right.
So it's foolish.
It's foolish because in some of the documentation, they're talking about the property line.
Okay.
You know, like, oh, this, like there's this actual property line. Well, a property line, it's abstract. It's not really it doesn't exist. Because where one property ends, the next property begins. So how wide is that gap?
The thickness of the line.
Of the line type of thing. It's like the hanging chad of this.
Pregnant chads,
right, you know, so they're kind of arguing that a little bit, and it's not a real line. You know, it's like this blade of grass is mine, the next one next to it's yours. If the fence wasn't there that these hunters built the... You know, one of them was a welder or a fabricator and
right.
built basically built a ladder that went up and over the fence. If the fence didn't exist, you could just step over it like a crack in the asphalt.
Right,
the concrete.
Where those just two parcels come together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You just walk right over it, and now you just left Joe Schmo's land, and now you're back into BLM land, and now you're hunting again or what have you. So the argument of, well, they touched my property line. No, they didn't. It's not a real thing.
You've bought and sold homes before.
Yeah.
You know the deal with, you get three different surveyors out there.
Yeah.
You're going to get a span of maybe a couple feet, like, oh, your property line's here, your property line's here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a, like you said, there aren't printed lines on the ground that, hey, this is the end all be all. Hey, this tree is slightly on your property, or no, it's slightly on mine. I mean, that's the nature.
The tree leans into my property.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're not going to go out in the field and separate some bushes and go, oh, here's the red line. That's not how it works. But in the law, it does state that if the two property owners agree on where the line exists to build a fence or to build a driveway or to construct something,
right,
then it's agreement between the two landowners, and wherever that item is placed is basically going to now represent the property line.
Yeah. And most landowners or property owners are fairly easy to get along with. I'll give a real world example. I got a big Russian olive tree that's in like no man's land between the side of my yard and the side of my neighbor's yard. I don't know where the property boundary is, but he's a cool guy. And we just agree, like, every now and then he does the pruning and maintenance on it. Every now and then I do the pruning and maintenance on it.
Well, you know, when you're out in the middle of nowhere and all of a sudden you see these pinyon juniper trunks as posts,
right,
and then you see, you know, barbed wire spun about to create a fence because they've just used, you know, the ranch hands have used the product that's been available to them, which are pinyon juniper trees or branches or what have you, to construct the fence.
You're not driving posts in rocky soil.
These individuals aren't out there with survey equipment going, Jimmy, 3 inches to the left is our property line. They're just going, yeah, I don't know, let's aim for that rock.
Right.
And just kind of lay it out. And then that just becomes that particular property line.
I mean, yeah.
It's an abstract construct. It's just a,
out in the middle of nowhere is kind of the key. And this case is kind of like the canary in the coal mine with this stuff, because I won't mention the ranch. I won't mention the area of the state, but there is some stuff going on in Nevada right now that we are slowly becoming more like some of these states. I think of Montana, Wyoming, where it is a real issue. There are landlocked sections of public land with ranches around them. How do you get to them? You know, there's got to be some sort of agreement on like an easement or an access, like, hey, yeah, this is private land that you own, but there's 10,000 acres of public land that nobody's going to be able to access if you lock this off. I could think of an area up there in 011.
Yeah, Northern Wash area.
Yeah,
there's a bunch up there.
A landowner has gated and locked roads that maybe he or she or they can't legally lock.
But they do.
So this stuff it's at our doorstep. And like I said, this case in Wyoming, it'll be interesting to see what probably take years, but what the final resolution is, because it's here. It's in Nevada.
Well, and I think the case in Wyoming is going to set the guidelines, the precedent for how some of this is dealt with.
When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about my deer hunt thus far, some Barney level mistakes I've made on it. And then after that, we'll get into a little bit of traditional archery, some recurve stuff.
Yeah, let's do it.
Perfect. When we come back on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Talk a little bit about my hunt thus far. I was kind of not reluctant, but there was a little bit of ego involved in going, man, do I want to tell this story or do I not want to tell this story?
Oh, you want to tell the story.
I'm going to tell the story. I'm going to put it out there because every time I think like, hey, I've got this figured out, all my stuff's wired tight, I know what I'm doing in the mountains, I'm not going to make a fool of myself, I do something like I did this last week. So I'll kind of talk through the hunt thus far. I've had opportunities every single day. It's been an incredible hunt thus far. You know, my buddy came out, he hunted with me. We got him 36 yards from a buck. It just was not the right buck. And I don't blame him one bit. He's very eager to get his first mule deer under his belt with a bow.
Yeah.
But this was like a Labrador retriever with a couple twigs taped to its head. So he said,
I bet you that lab would have tasted pretty
probably,
fine.
Yeah, probably would have tasted good. But he got up there and, you know, he had an arrow knocked and he said, no, I just don't, not now. Like, you know, we're 3 days into the season at that point. And I don't blame him. Now, to me, I've had opportunities on mature deer each day, except for the one that I was helping my buddy out. Here's what I did. I'm just going to air this for public consumption. Think of me what you will. I did not know this deer was there. I was going slow. I was making my way across a ridgeline, kind of stopping, picking apart bowls as I'm going slow. This deer stood up, and it is a really heavy, tall, wide deer. Would have been probably my best of all time. Stands up. I quickly use my rangefinder. He's at 62 yards. I think perfect. That's right in my wheelhouse. Before I went out on this hunt, I was shooting softball-sized groups at about 70 with broadheads. So I thought, okay, 62. This is in my wheelhouse. No problem. I draw. As I'm drawing, he notices, you know, I mean, he noticed me anyway, but now he's really like, hey, that thing's moving. So he starts taking steps. I settle my 60-yard pin, cheated slightly high because I thought, 62, a couple inches there, I'm good. Well, he keeps going, and he walks probably 6 or 7 steps. My 60-yard pin never left the spot. The way he was walking, slightly quartering away, the shot we talked about that we both love, slightly quartered away, he probably put another 8 to 10 yards on me.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, depending on.
Yeah. So there I am, and I think, okay, perfect. I exhale. I start to break apart the bow. I'm pulling into that back wall. Arrow goes off, couple inches under his chest. Blows up on a rock behind him. And as I'm watching the arrow flight through my sight, it impacts right where my 70-yard pin was. So a smart thinking person would have, as soon as that deer stopped, would have bumped to my 70-yard pin.
Well, I wouldn't go that far though.
I don't know.
A regular smart person. Because, you know, when you're in that kind of a situation and you see the animals start to move, your brain is like just assuming it's moving parallel.
And the way he was facing,
You know, sometimes it's not a bad idea to, when you do see the animal, if they're quartering away or to you, to take a couple reference points, you know, if you see a bush or a rock or, you know, some kind of a flowering, whatever, something. Yeah. If they do start to move, you know, you can kind of gauge. But, man, that's in the heat of the moment.
And by surprise.
Yeah, it's tough. But that's how sometimes the brain works, is when you're in that ultra-focused mode and something is moving like that, your brain is kind of triggered to think parallel.
Oh, that's where I was.
That's what you did. And so you didn't do anything wrong. You know, you're just like the rest of us. And we just kind of play that game. But
yeah, it was gut-wrenching. It was a rough one. I mean, thank God I didn't hit. It was a clean miss, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the good thing, because that would have
100%.
That would have absolutely sucked.
It was perfect. My left to right was perfect. It went right where I wanted it to. Just about 8 inches low.
See, all that practice? The takeaway positive is
it was a good shot.
You're steady on your shot. You're following through correctly.
Just wasn't where it was supposed to be.
The deer wasn't where the arrow was.
No, absolutely not. You bring up a good point, and that's, you know, if it's a controlled situation, right? You've got them bedded. I know, okay, I'm looking at like the picture I took when I was glassing or whatever. I've got my stalk planned out. I kind of know like my step, I'll keep a step count.
Yeah.
So it was as I'm closing, so I don't have to range it again. Yeah. I'll range like what I think, okay, there, he's facing this way. If he gets up and goes to this clump of sage, that's at this distance. If he goes to this, he's at that distance. But in a situation like this, I had looked hard in that bowl and I did not see deer in there. And I gave it a little bit before I started moving, but they disappear in that tall stuff.
Oh, yeah, they do. Yeah. They just vanish. And when I'm trying to do a stalk, I will, if I know the animal's, say, 140 yards out or so, and I'm stalking up on it, just like you were saying, I'll range the stuff in front of me that I'm going to try to get to, so that if something does jump, well, and my math is pretty horrible, so when I'm ranging, it's got to be a 0 or a 5 at the end.
Gotcha.
So that I can subtract really easy.
Yeah.
You know, so
we've talked about your college experience. I'm going to call BS on that, but go ahead.
I'm telling you, man.
Nah.
But, I'll obviously range the animal the best I can, especially if they're behind something or whatever, and then just kind of range points that I'm going to try to make it to. So if something does happen in a split second, I'm not dinkering around looking for my range finder. I'm just like, okay, take 25 yards off of 100. Okay, 75. All right, let's do this.
Yeah, I did not do that on this one, man. Well, stood up and it was like,
up on you.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah, you were lucky to be able to even use the range finder to
get an accurate.
Yeah, because usually sometimes on those, you're just going old school, you know, back in the day when we didn't have rangefinders, and you're like going, okay, let's see, that bush is 5, that's 10, that's 20, that's okay. Okay, he's all right, let's do, okay, go. But that's where a lot of ranging is. I always tell people when they're like, man, I'm not good at ranging. You know, you're like, well, in those situations where things happen super quick, yeah, you're ranging it, but you're also blocking it. So you have pins on there that'll your pins will be, you know, say 20 to 60 on your scope.
Right.
Well, you know,
if it's at this yardage, here's where those pins are.
Yeah, you're looking at him going, okay, he's going to be between like 25 and 40 yards is what I'm thinking that deer's at. So you can group. You can get your 20 high, put your 40 low.
See where it brackets.
Just block those and put all three of those pins like in the sweet spot. Just let them float right there in the chest, right there in the sweet spot. Because lungs are big.
Oh,
when you're talking a target, I mean, it's the size of a small hubcap.
Yeah.
I mean, you should be able to smoke that thing at 80 yards if you practice on a regular basis. But
and tune your bow to your broadheads.
And tune your bow to your broadheads. So, so you'll block it, but in your situation, man, it was like, it was go time and you had seconds, but I commend you, man. I commend you for doing, doing as well as you did.
I'll take the compliment, but
your hunt's extended. You still get to hunt.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I got through the 9th, September 9th. So I still got time, and we were talking a little earlier. I'm pretty confident at this point. I found some, 6 or 7 mature bucks that I really want to go after. I will say back on the ranging thing real quick. This is something that I learned the hard way and apparently still haven't really learned because I goofed it up. But, you know, I wear one of those bino harness things, the old school Alaska guide creation one.
Uh-huh.
And I keep my rangefinder pocket open so I can grab it real quick. But what I've seen people do before in the heat of the moment is they're clicking, 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 getting their range. And then they're like trying to stuff it back in the pocket and zip the pocket closed.
Oh, yeah. That's nuts.
I run mine on a short little bungee thing so I can stretch it to my eye. But in this case, I threw it up 62 and just drop it. And then I'm attaching my release and I'm on my bow. You know, don't use the super long bungees they come with because you might clank that sucker off a rock. But people trying to put those things away, I've seen it happen.
Or catch it on your string, on your
catch
release.
It on the string or something. Mine hangs low enough to where I can just click and then drop, and it's down here. It's out of the way, and then I can go into the shot. I'm not wasting seconds trying to stuff it back in a pocket, zip it closed, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, hey, I'll take the compliment, Dave. It was, like I said, it was hard. afterwards knowing exactly like, man, I would be done and I'd have a phenomenal deer down right now. Big body, tons of meat for the freezer.
Well, you know where to go now, though. When you get back up there, you've got a couple focal points and places to really focus on. You'll locate those deer again. In that particular area you're going, they're not going to move too far. There's a lot there for them, and they're going to go too far because they're not going to leave that pristine, that shelter, the food, the water.
Let's talk a little bit about recurves. It's a super fun way to shoot. It's a super fun way to hunt. We'll get into all of that stuff after the break here on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. The struggle stick, stick and string, whatever you want to call it. Dave, you are a, I'll call you a recurve expert. Can we go there? Take the compliment.
I'll take the compliment, but I'm...
No, you teach this stuff, right?
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about, let's go traditional, like Olympic recurve archery stuff first. Let's talk about the target side, and then we can get into a little bit about the hunting with one and all of that. So you're a USA archery certified level something or other coach?
Yeah, NTS, level three NTS coach. So,
okay.
You know, the big thing between recurve, because I coach both compound and recurve, but lately I've got my recurve students, my Olympic recurve students. And so Olympic recurve is, if any of you know, is like Brady Ellison, one of the world's best Olympic recurve shooters on the national and world stage. Absolutely fantastic weapon. I love shooting mine. It is so cool. The reason I like it is because it is so... There's so much to it.
Oh,
it is completely different than shooting a compound. I mean, compound has the gears. It's got the cams. You draw it. You have less weight when it comes to a full draw because of the let off. But Olympic recurve and recurve in general is just a solid fluid motion.
You're in the shot from start to finish.
From start to finish. And you have to be really consistent to have those really solid shots.
And consistent form-wise is
exactly
what you're talking
about. Consistent form. As well as, I mean, the bow has to perform well as well. It's, people think, oh, I just get a recurve, I put a string on it, and I throw an arrow in the knot, and I knock an arrow, and I just start flinging arrows down the lane. No big deal. It's really easy. You still have to tune it.
Yes.
It still has to be tuned. Your brace height, you know, from the riser, the handle, to the string, you know, it has to be within a tolerance. So, you know, when you put your string on, you have a lot of people, I put 7 twists into my string.
Right.
So that I get that brace height at about 7.5. There's a lot of things, how it sits on the rest. Do you use a plunger? Is the plunger out, you know, is a plunger out at an eighth? Is it a quarter? Is it a 16th? A lot of nuances that you do need to deal with. I mean, it's got to be tuned.
And
it's tuned to you. So it's not, you can't go to a book and go, okay, I need to set this to this, and I need to set that to that, and like you can with a compound.
Yes. Yeah. Well, even I'll use the example of the Hoyt Satori that I got.
Fantastic bow.
It's an awesome bow, but they give you a range. You know, like with compounds, when you look at the owner's manual, it's going to say, hey, you need set this to 13/16, and it's a very exact, precise thing. With that Satori, the manual's like, your brace height should be between like 7 and 9.5 inches or something like that. It gives you a range.
A huge range.
To play with. And for me personally, I'm not... The target stuff fascinates me, the Olympic recurve stuff. I have not gone down that road yet, but hunting with a recurve, you're absolutely right. You'll find that sweet spot where I can set my brace height to that and the bow suddenly is quiet.
Yeah.
It's shock free. And you'll find, what do I want to call them? It's like an accuracy node for a brace height, we'll call it, where at that brace height, I'm hitting peak quietness. Or I guess that peak quietness doesn't make sense, but
Like almost like a performance thing. It's just,
yeah, it's, it settles. It's quiet and it's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where I go. I'll sacrifice a little quietness if like I find, okay, it's much more accurate at 8 1/4 versus 7 3/4 or something. You can put string dampeners on and all that stuff on a hunting setup.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, I can quiet it down, but you look for those accuracy nodes in there and the tuning
and this
process.
Brace size is going to change the poundage of the bow.
So that's a good
big
point.
Deal. So, you know, folks that just strap a string on there and get the fling in, they may not notice much at 10 or 15 yards or so, but once you start pushing a little further and you do that over and over and your brace height is changing between 7 9 1/2 because you're not, you know, managing that part of your shooting format, you're going to struggle.
Yeah,
you're not going to have any consistency because the bow's at a different weight. With a compound bow, once you come to draw, you hit the wall. And at that wall, your compound bow is the weight that you've set it to. So 55 pounds, 60 pounds, 62 pounds. Boom, you hit the wall. You are at 62 pounds every single time you draw that thing.
Right.
With a recurve, if you aren't consistent with your draw and bringing it back to the exact same spot on your face or where your anchor point is, and then continue pulling through, because it's not supposed to be. You're not supposed to what we call twanging, you know, or plucking,
boom.
Where you just let go of the string with your fingers or open your palm really quick. It's supposed to be fluid. As you draw, you relax your hand, and then the string just slides right off the fingertips. If that's not consistent and you're drawing back an extra 1/4 inch, an extra 1/2 inch, or releasing an inch before where you should, you're going to be shooting anywhere from, you know, whatever it might be. Say you're both set at 50, you might be shooting at 43 pounds if it's too shallow, or you might be shooting at 54 pounds if you're pulling back too far. So the consistency, the form consistency, and the draw consistency with a recurve is critical.
And I've seen that. I'll go out some days and I'll shoot lights out. I've sent you pictures before of a group where I go out and the first group I shoot, I'm stacking them and I'm like, oh, this is great. And then the very next group is like huge. I'm going, okay, I'm doing something wrong here.
I'm changing something.
So. What do you use as an anchor point?
So on my draw, I'll come back to my draw. And as soon as I hit the very front of my jaw, just below like the crease in my lip, right there is my point where I start to expand my shoulder blades.
Okay.
And at that time, the string should be just about at the tips of my fingers.
Gotcha.
And as I expand from there and start to relax the fingers, my draw will end right before the end of my jaw or my mandible.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So I've got about 1/2 inch after I hit my jaw. After I hit the front, I've got about 1/2 inch before my fingers can't hold the string any longer and it comes off my fingers.
Okay. And this is another thing, anchor point, right? It's very, with a compound, it was a weird concept to me when I really got into recurve archery or traditional archery.
Yeah.
That it's like almost like a moving anchor point. Like you said, the shot process, right, is I'm starting to do something different once I hit a certain point. I'm not sitting at a static anchor point and just aiming and holding like you are with a compound.
Right.
Does that make sense?
No,
it
does.
Did I say that?
You said that right. Because if you look at like Olympic shooters, because we'll shoot with what's called a clicker.
Yes.
So it's just a bar that goes on the opposite side of our arrow during the draw.
Right.
And once we draw and we go past that clicker, it clicks and hits the riser. So it makes a noise. It's just a click, a little clicking sound on the riser. And at that point, boom, the release is supposed to occur. You're supposed to have that fluid shot to where it clicks and your finger should be releasing the string. That's consistent. You're always drawn to the same distance. You're always drawn to, 29 1/4 inches. Boom, click, boom, shoot.
Okay.
So you try to emulate that with a hunting recurve without the clicker because you're trying to eliminate noise.
Yeah, you don't want something clicking.
And you can't
click
past a broadhead. I mean, it's not designed that way. But you're looking for that same performance.
Now, somebody told me once, basically, once it goes off, to have the mental image of picking a golf ball off your shoulder.
Correct, yeah.
Like the follow through.
The follow through, yeah. So if you videotape yourself shooting a recurve or longbow, traditional equipment, and you shoot the bow, fingers are still underneath your jaw or, you know, sitting on the front of your chest or something. That's showing that you're not following through, which you're letting go of the string and not letting the string come off your fingers. As you're drawing and it comes off, your hand, since it's still pulling, is going to move backwards. So it's going to be just like, yeah, hitting a golf ball or something off your shoulder, and your hand is going to end up right near your ear, behind your ear.
Yeah. So I don't know why that visual reference stuck with me, but it was like, okay, after I break the shot, pick a golf ball off my shoulder.
Correct.
It's like, oh, okay, that made sense to me. So that's what I do now. Well, actually, we should probably save this. Looking at the time, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about aiming or instinctive shooting versus aiming with Olympic recurve target stuff. There's a pin or something, right?
Yes. Yeah, there's a pin. There's a pin. It can't be magnified like competition compound bows can be. They can have a magnification a lens in there. Olympic recurve cannot. It's just a pin or a dot on a piece of glass.
But you can actually kind of zero that. You can move that. And
it's very similar to a competition compound sight where it's movable. So you can slide it up and down, because in some Olympic recurve competitions, FIDE competitions and stuff, you'll be shooting at multiple distances. You'll be shooting at 30 meters, 50 meters, 70 meters, 90 meters, which 90 meters is 98.68 yards.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're thinking about it.
Man, that's a shot.
Yeah, trust me. And you're shooting 60 arrows at that distance.
Well, hey, let's talk about the aiming thing. We'll talk a little bit about hunting with traditional equipment when we come back on Nevada Backcountry. Now, before we went to break, we started to talk a little bit about aiming, I'll call it. Somebody once told this to me, and it made a lot of sense. I think it was my brother. He's a traditional archery guy. But he said, well, a pitcher doesn't aim, like hold the ball out and aim where he wants it to go and then make the throw. It's that kind of coordination between what he's looking at and and that throwing motion. So that was his argument for what I've heard referred to as an instinctive type of archery. So full disclosure, I tried that year I took my mule deer with a recurve. I shot my recurve bow every single day, almost twice a day, for like 8 months leading up to that. And I felt dialed. Now, I never felt 100% confident with that instinctive thing.
Yeah.
This is, hopefully there are no purists out there listening to this. This is going to make me sound like I cheated the system or something. But I took a silver Sharpie and I had a dot on the riser. And that was my 25-yard dot. And I knew with my arrow coming out of that recurve that 25, that dot was just to the right of where I wanted the arrow to impact. But, you know, vertically, it was right mid center mass on a deer. And then I knew out to about 32-ish, I could put it on its back. And then any closer than 25, that's when I kind of would do the almost instinctive thing. But I can't do the instinctive thing. I don't know what.
You could.
I can group.
Yeah.
But they don't group in the same spot.
Yeah. It's just one of those things. So as I was stating in the last segment, you're going through the processes of how to shoot a recurve and all of that. So that is a lot of USA archery training. And that's how a lot of the instruction goes. When you get down to the purists and to the like the hardcore traditionalists, the way that they shoot is all about themselves. Every single one of them has a different way of shooting the bow, different way of releasing, different way of drawing the bow, different way of holding the bow. It's very much a comfort thing, what feels good to them. Most of them are instinctive.
Okay.
I've seen individuals where they've got their bow sitting at like a 45-degree angle, and they draw the bow, and it's like right up against their face, and their nose is slammed on the string, and they hold it.
Okay, so they stay at like an anchor point.
They stay at that point. You know, then they shoot, and they're fantastic with it. I've seen other shooters where they'll have the bow, and they don't even come to like what I would consider full draw, you know, somewhere along the side of my face or on the side of my mouth or the corner of my mouth.
That right.
They're letting go. Like as soon as they touch the tip of their chin, their shot is done in 2 seconds. I mean, they draw. It's just like this real quick. Boink. That true instinctive is visualizing your shot. Like keeping an eye on the animal or the target, you know, the yellow in the target or the blue in the target. And that's what you're focused on. And you're watching that instinctively, just imagining the shot.
What was the guy's name? Byron Ferguson.
Uh-huh.
You know who I'm talking about? The guy that likes shoot aspirin out of the air and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't even look like he comes to a full draw.
No.
And I think he's passed away now.
Yeah, a couple years back. But yeah, he's one of those ones where the draw cycle never stopped. As soon as he started drawing the bow, he would get somewhere near the front of his chin, you know, somewhere right around the very beginning of his face, and then fling it. And then you'd see his hand come, you know,
way out,
like behind his head somewhere. You know, but he was also shooting like a 75-pound longbow.
Oh, for real?
Oh, yeah. The bow was like ridiculous.
That's like medieval weaponry.
Oh, yeah. Completely. But yeah, but that was pure 100% instinctive because his big claim to fame was shooting really small moving targets.
Yeah, like an aspirin and stuff. Yeah.
You can't technically. Like we would with our compound bows when we're in competition where you can put that lens right on the target and hold, pull, boom, and shoot. No, he is just yanking and ripping.
Yeah.
I mean, not even 2 seconds, and that arrow's in the air.
People listening, if you don't know what Dave and I are talking about, go to YouTube and look
Google.
Up. Yeah, or Google Byron Ferguson
archery. And check out some of his stuff, man.
It's crazy.
There's still people out there that think it's all like Photoshop fake stuff.
Oh.
He was doing this in the 40s at circuses and
state fairs
and stuff.
So he would be a prime example of a 100% instinctive archer.
All day long.
Okay.
All day long. And I kind of do more of the instinctive because I've tried some of those where people say, well, before you draw, you put the tip of the arrow where you want it to be.
Right. Yep.
And then you hold steady, draw, follow through, shoot, boom, go. And then at the next yardage, you know you need to hold it 5 inches above the target that you're aiming at. And then at 70 yards, you need to hold it like where the moon is cresting, you know, that kind of stuff. And I've tried that so many times and it hasn't clicked. I still fart around with it because I'm like, I'm going to get this eventually. This has to click. It's going to click for me eventually. But right now, I could probably shoot something with my longbow. I would say 35 yards is probably my comfort.
Yeah.
And even then, it would have to be like not moving and maybe tied to something.
Okay.
Because, I'm not there yet.
Yeah. But I shot my deer at 26, first arrow.
Oh, nice.
I will tell you a cool experience, though, hunting with it was my first time hunting with traditional stuff. A weird experience hunting with traditional stuff. The first arrow zipped right through it, 26 yards. It didn't go but 10 feet because the things are like so quiet. The deer, after having an arrow go through both lungs and the liver, it walked like 10 feet and stopped. And I shot again, put another arrow through it. And it didn't, I shot three because then it kind of did the hop and went off to like 30 something. And I knew
you just pincushioned that poor fella.
And every shot was fatal.
Yeah.
I mean, every shot was right where it was supposed to be.
The rule is keep shooting until they're on the ground. But yeah,
it was weird with a compound. It's so loud when it goes off. Or it's not that loud, but I think it does, like, they spook, man. Like, when you hit them, they run.
Yeah.
This was a weird experience where it didn't do that, and then finally, the third and final arrow at 30-something yards, that was like, okay, it did the kind of hind leg kick thing and did the death sprint for, like, 75 yards and then keeled over.
Keeled over.
But it was just
how did you aim on those?
On those, I had my dot, man. I had my silver Sharpie dot.
Oh, you had your little
silver
Sharpie dot.
Yeah.
Because some people do. They'll reference parts on their riser.
Yes.
You know, another way that folks, they'll aim with the tip of the arrow at full draw for that short moment.
that never made sense to me, though. Because
it never made sense to me.
It looks like you're aiming in the dirt.
Yeah, and then I'm also the fluid shooter where my draw doesn't stop. I would have a hard time doing that one. And then the other one is folks will aim off the shelf.
Oh, use the shelf. Okay.
Use the shelf as what they're aiming with. So it really comes down to what are you seeing when you're drawing the bow? What is something that on the bow or on that's in front of you or on your person that you can use as that reference that does not move, that's constant every time you shoot?
Yes. Yeah.
So that's the kicker. What is your constant? What does not move? So some people will put lines on their riser.
Yeah. You know,
different colored lines on their riser. They'll put little pins in. I've seen actually an individual once out in the field who had two colored push pins.
Oh, like, stuck like on there?
That you stuck on a cork board or something?
Right.
Two different colored push pins that he had pushed into the riser.
Okay. And, you know, back up for a second. We should have probably said this stuff. If you're out there listening and you're going, hey, what in the heck is a shelf? What's a riser? So on traditional archery equipment, the riser would be the part that you basically hang on to. That's what your hand goes on.
Yeah.
And then the shelf is sort of the cut into the riser where the arrow rests.
Where the arrow either rests or you have the arrow rest attached to that part. That would be the shelf.
So that's what we're talking about to give you a visual reference. I will say, let me step back real quick. That dot, I'm not using it to aim. I'm 100% focused on where I want to hit.
Right.
But it's kind of in my peripheral.
That you can use as kind of your
up and down. Yeah, exactly.
I'm assuming this individual was using the push pins as his actual. Well, and it'd be tough because I don't know if you could with a.
That'd cover up a whole lot on the target.
Well, I mean, it's on the riser itself. So
okay.
you really wouldn't be able to use it as a, like putting it on the animal.
Yeah,
it would
be
more of like what you're saying, your reference of how high you need to be.
Yes.
Because it'd be off to your right and or left, depending on your shooting form. Thank you, everybody, again for joining us this Sunday. It's a beautiful day, so get up, get out, and shoot. We have Tom Gresham's Gun Talk coming in at 11 o'clock, so stay tuned for that on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.